Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, raising awareness and inspiring action for personal and planetary health with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 36 for the year. Emma, I was just talking to my mum last night. We're already at 64 total episodes, which is quite a feat at just 18 months.
Yep. We've been hard at work, working our fingers to the bones here.
Now, as always, bit of admin, head over to our website. You'll find all 64 episodes, including this one, on the website, as well as some of the campaigns we're working on. And make sure you subscribe as well and subscribe to the newsletter and this podcast. Emma, we are going down a little bit of a different path today.
That's right. Yep. So today we are very lucky to be joined by two wonderful guests, Megan Grant and Gabrielle Henderson, both from the University of Tasmania and currently doing work with Adrift Lab. So Megan is a PhD candidate and Gabrielle is a marine biology student. And today they'll be chatting to us about plastic debris in seabirds. Now, this is a topic that was touched on recently in our podcast by another Adrift Lab team member, Dr. Jack Orty. Please, if you haven't heard that one, go back and take a listen. That was a really well-received episode. So we consider ourselves very lucky today to be able to expand on some of those talking points in more detail with Megan and Gabrielle. Ladies, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's an absolute honour. Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. Now, Megan, you've done a few podcasts in the past. Gabrielle, this is your very first podcast interview.
Yeah, sure is. My podcast debut.
Brilliant. So, look, we normally interview, a lot of academics and researchers that have got years of experience. And when we ask them about their journey to that current point, there's quite a backstory. But this is unique because we're interviewing now, yourselves that are very fresh in this sort of field of work, which is quite unique. So both of you, Megan, Gabrielle, tell us a little bit about your respective journeys, but more so why you got so interested into getting into what you're doing now.
While it is still, I haven't been doing this for very long. This is my eighth year at university. I lose track. But it has been a huge journey so far. So I started out doing a Bachelor of Applied Science in the marine environment, and my major was fisheries management. So how can we manage wild catch fisheries? And I got to the end of that 3-year degree and I sort of realized that it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do anymore. While it's still a very important topic in today's society, it just didn't really pique my interest anymore. So I decided to continue on and do my honors, which is a year-long research project. And I started looking around for supervisors. And at my campus, I'm based up in Launceston in Tasmania, all of the supervisors were fisheries or aquaculture based, apart from this one supervisor who studied seabirds and plastics. And I thought, perfect, this is actually just what I want to do. I'm really interested in plastics. And seabirds are really cool. So I inquired with her. And she sent me an email back and she's like, yeah, no worries, come in and let's have a chat. So I came in and I was super nervous because I've never met her before. Her name is Jennifer Lavers. And she sort of said, she's like, oh, so I've actually just had a permit approved. And it's to go work out on a remote island off the coast of Port Hedland in Western Australia to work on seabirds and plastic in their nests. If you're interested, do you want to come? The only caveat is we have to leave in 2 weeks. And I'd only literally just finished my bachelor's degree. I was you know, it was still like the, yeah, within weeks of me finishing. And I was like, sure, all right, I'll go out to this island. And it all just snowballed from there, I guess. So I went out to this island with Jen and a few others, and this island is incredible. It's about 100 kilometres off the coast of Port Hedland. It's home to seabirds and pretty much not much else. There's no trees on the island. There's no shade. It's about 40 degrees and humid. But it was incredible. I absolutely loved it. And yeah, that was the start of my honours project. And Jen always says that I have had one of the best possible honours projects because I went to not one but two remote islands during my project. So a couple of months later, I won a scholarship from the Women Divers Hall of Fame, and I travelled out to American Samoa and then out to a tiny little island literally in the middle of the Pacific Ocean called Rose Atoll. It's a US Marine National Monument and Wildlife Refuge, and it's closed to the public, so I could confidently say that probably no more than 1,000 people have ever been to this island. And again, I worked on seabirds and plastics in their nests. And yeah, it was incredible. And then I got to the end of my honours and thought, you know, Adrift Lab is such a supportive and welcoming environment. Jen is fantastic. And the other lab head, Alex Bond, who works at the Natural History Museum in London, is also fantastic. And I couldn't imagine working under anyone else. So continued on, and now I'm doing my PhD.
I was just going to say, I bet you're the envy of all of your friends sitting, you know, like in a lab staring down a microscope all day doing their honours and PhD work. So I think you've chosen well there with your project.
Definitely, yeah. It definitely has a lot of perks.
And Gabrielle, can you tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into this space, and also maybe tell us a little bit about what it's like as an undergrad student working for Adrift Lab, because that sounds like a fantastic opportunity for students.
Yeah, sure. First up, I just want to say I've never heard Megan's full story before, and I'm definitely one of those jealous people right now. I'm like, oh. So I'm currently in my final semester of my third year Bachelor of Marine and Antarctic Science, which all in all has been an amazing experience. I actually moved to Tassie from New South Wales specifically for this degree and for like IMAS and all of the really like well-known academics they have there. And so it was a bit of a weird story. Like, I kind of started this year, 2021, and I was like, seaweeds are my passion. I love seaweed. I want to become a seaweed scientist. Like, I was 100% dedicated to the like seaweed. And I emailed a bunch of people and was like, oh, do you have projects for like second semester? Could I do a research project with you? And they were all super busy and were like, no, sorry, I can't take you. And then I just remembered having a class in like second year where Jen had spoken about plastics and seabirds. And I was like, I wonder if that could be something. And so I emailed Jen and she was like, yep, can take you definitely second semester. I have this really cool project that I can do. And then kind of similar to Megan, I just kind of went, yep, this sounds great. And through doing that, I've definitely become way more passionate about seabirds and plastic pollutions than maybe I anticipated. I'm definitely like, it's such an important issue right now. And I'm really excited to be involved in sort of the research and starting to get deeper into some of the effects of plastic pollution. And being like an undergrad is definitely intimidating because the Adrift Lab is so, they're all so well known, and even the students in like honours and PhDs, they're all so like passionate and excited to be there, but also super friendly. So it's been a really welcoming environment for me to be in. And I've really felt like well supported by everyone, which has been really great. And obviously I've gotten some pretty cool opportunities because I'm here today talking on a podcast with you guys.
And what's also been quite interesting is when you go onto the Adrift website and you look at the profiles of all the, I guess, your core staff, and which I think, Megan, you are one of them now, but also all the students, PhD, honours and undergrads and so on, what a high proportion of women. I mean, that must be inspiring for you, Gabrielle, coming into, you know, you apply for all these places to your research or projects or whatever, and a lot of times in research industry, it's very male-dominated, isn't it? And yet you come to this environment, and how inspiring it must be for up-and-coming female scientists, researchers, et cetera, to be in such an inspiring environment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was one of the reasons I approached Jen in the first place. She's just so, like, I don't know how to phrase it, just well known. She's like just such a big scientist, but she's also just like the sweetest person. And it's been really good to have like that female mentor in such a like interesting field.
Now, Megan, we see that you've, I don't know how recent or how old, but probably more recent than old. 3-minute thesis. You is something that you presented. You were a finalist, I think, more recently in this. And has there been an outcome with that?
It was last year. I entered the 3-minute thesis, University of Tasmania round. And for those who don't know, the 3-minute thesis is, like the name suggests, it's you have to present your thesis in 3 minutes. You absolutely cannot go over 3 minutes because then you're pretty much disqualified. So it's a pretty hard feat. I decided to present one of my thesis chapters, which looked at plastic deposition in shearwater colonies on Lord Howe Island, because I had just got some results from that. So I entered the competition with my video. So it was all virtual last year because of the pandemic. And I was fortunate to be one of the finalists for the UTAS round, which is pretty exciting. Unfortunately, I didn't win anything. I didn't go through to any other rounds or anything, but it was still really exciting to get to be a finalist and to know that I'm doing okay with my PhD, which is always nice to know.
Absolutely. Now you punched, like, you in that 3 minutes, it's such a short time, but you really like packed in a lot of information in that, and quite heartbreaking facts and figures that you've included there. You were talking about that plastic polluted paradise. You mentioned that's Lord Howe Island. For the benefit of the listeners who may not know, could you give us a bit of a rundown on the island itself? Because you would think, given its location, it would be quite a pristine area.
And start off by telling us where it is, because I looked it up and I don't even know there were any islands where it is. Tell us where it is. Where
for
is
the Kiwis.
Lord Howe? Yeah, for the Kiwis.
So Lord Howe Island is located in the Tasman Sea, about 600 kilometres off the coast of New South Wales, or roughly like Newcastle. So it's almost halfway between Australia and New Zealand. It is a lush tropical island. It's beautiful. It's home to the world's southernmost coral reef. And the island is home to dense aggregations of seabirds and terrestrial birds, and wildlife and endemic plants and everything. It really is sort of like a paradise. There are about, I think it's about 200 or 300 permanent residents on the island, but is, you know, in summertime and, well, a lot of the time throughout the year is also hosts lots of tourists. It is a very touristy, you know, hotspot, and especially throughout the pandemic as well, because, you know, in Australia we aren't able to travel to international countries. So Lord Howe Island has been sort of one of those places that you can sort of get to, and it's almost like you're leaving Australia, but you're not really. Because it is so remote from, you know, the Australian mainland and from any other country, you would think that it is, you know, a pristine environment. But, you know, if you walk along any of the beaches, you will find typical marine pollution. So anywhere from, you know, things such as like nurdles, which are pre-production plastic pellets. They're tiny little balls of plastic resin. And those nurdles, they get melted down into all sorts of everyday plastic items like buckets, pens, toys, you name it, it's probably made from a nurdle. You can find nurdles on beaches. You can find, like straws, plastic fragments, fishing debris, all sorts of things. And I guess the really sad thing is these plastics are not coming from the island itself. The island has quite good waste management practices, but this plastic is washing up on the beach from other places. So, ocean currents move plastics around, you know, around all of the oceans in the world, and, you know, these plastics wash up on beaches all over the place, and Lord Howe Island is just one of those places. But what my research focused on, and what I focused on in the 3-minute thesis, is the deposition of plastic items by flesh-footed shearwaters, which, you know, they're also known as mutton birds. They're a small seabird. They're quite incredible, really. They fly from Lord Howe Island all the way up to the Sea of Japan and spend about 5 years up there. And then they come back down to breed on Lord Howe Island. And they make that entire journey without stopping. It's incredible for such a small bird. But these birds are also well known to ingest significant quantities of plastics. And this is something that Jen and Alex and now Jack are studying. So Jen and Alex have been studying it for the last, I think it's 11 or 12 years. And have just released a paper summarizing that entire period. But we find huge quantities of plastics that have been ingested by these birds. So I think that the maximum we found was 276 pieces in one 90-day-old chick. And the chicks are fed solely by their parents up until they fledge, which is when they're about 90 days old. You know, and it's so heartbreaking seeing young birds so full of plastics, and often because their stomachs are so full of plastics, they have no room for any other food, and they're also not getting nutrition from any of the plastics. So when they go to fledge and they have to fly all the way up to the Sea of Japan, they are malnourished, underweight, their wings may be too small, they may not have all of their adult feathers yet, and, you know, often they don't make it, or they don't even leave the island. They can't. They're not strong enough. But yeah, sorry, that's not actually the topic of what I was going on about now. But so I've been looking at plastics deposited on Lord Howe Island by the shearwaters, and these plastics can be deposited when the adults feed their chicks, and so they regurgitate their meals to the chicks, and some spillage can occur. So some plastics may land on the colony floor during this process. Shearwaters also produce what's called a bolus, and this is basically a regurgitated pellet of all the indigestible parts of their diet, and it should contain things such as squid beaks, but a lot of the time they contain plastics instead. So that's another way for plastics to be deposited on Lord Howe Island. And then the third way is when, like I was saying before, sometimes the chicks don't make it, and they may die on the island, And once they decompose, they're basically all the plastics that they've ingested will be scattered through the colony. So over a period of 3 years, so 2018 to 2020, I measured the amount of plastics that the birds are depositing, and we found 688,000 pieces every single year are deposited by the birds, which is a phenomenal amount of plastic considering there are roughly 22,000 pairs. That's, you know, that's, it's the equivalent of about 30 pieces per pair. It's a huge amount. It's hard to fathom really quite how much plastic that is.
Yeah, that's just absolutely like mind-blowing and heartbreaking at the same time. I just kind of needed a moment to absorb that, because that's and that would just be so tough to actually see in real life when you're on the ground doing this work. In your thesis, you mentioned, you know, like 15% of the body weight can be coming from plastic. So that's like, that would be the equivalent of me having about 10 kilos of plastic in my system. That's just ridiculous. Like, what? Why? Either of you can answer this, but it might be a simple answer. But why are these birds ingesting plastic at such high amounts?
There's a number of reasons why they might be ingesting plastics. One, it could look like their food. That's a possibility. Another is that once plastic has been in the marine environment for a little while, it grows a biofilm around the plastic, which is basically just, algae and other bits and pieces. So you know how a buoy might be in the ocean for a while and you pull it up and it has all sorts of things growing off it. That's exactly what happens with plastics in the ocean. So once they start growing this biofilm, they start smelling really good. So the birds might ingest them because they smell really good. So that sort of, it's like they either look like their food or they smell like their food or both. So that's, yeah, I think that's the main two sort of mechanisms there. But I mean, there's still a lot that we don't know. So we're still learning all the time. It's a rapidly evolving topic.
Now, in a 2018 paper that you were a part of, the use of anthropogenic. Am I saying that right? Marine debris as a nesting material by brown boobies. Can you first tell us, define what the anthropogenic, I can't say this properly, marine debris is? What is it actually?
It's essentially just any man-made solid material that in one way or another has ended up in the ocean. So when we're looking at anthropogenic marine debris, if you want to give it a name, we're looking at like metals, glass, paper, but by far the most dominant type that most papers will focus on is plastics, and that can come in like so many different forms. So you've got like the hard plastic fragments, which Megan was describing before, and then also a lot of thread-like plastics, which includes like fishing line and fishing netting, and then also like styrofoam and like plastic bags, just a whole bunch of stuff.
Talking about plastic pellets, it was in the news literally probably about a couple of weeks ago. I think a container ship or some containers blew off. This was in Hong Kong, I think, and it was full of plastic pellets. And the imagery that it showed of how beaches were just covered in this stuff. And when we talk about pellets, they go everywhere, in between all the rocks, in between all the crevices. It becomes part of the sand. And we're good on them doing, you know, a lot of volunteers trying to clean up. But one can only imagine that something like that, a component with all the sea currents, is going to reach a location like Lord Howe Island or even mainland. But in general, do we know where a lot of this debris comes from? I mean, is New Zealand to blame? Is Australia to blame? Or is this coming from the Northern Hemisphere, but just the way it's circulating in the currents, that's what's ending up here? And vice versa, our debris is ending up there. Do we have an indication of that?
There definitely has been a handful of papers in, you know, the last 5 or so years that describe a lot of where the plastic comes from. And I mean, a lot of plastic that ends up in the ocean comes from rivers. So the rivers wash the plastics out. And I can't remember exactly what rivers, but there's the top sort of 20 polluting rivers in the world. Without sort of pointing the finger, I guess, a lot of them do come from sort of Southeast Asia and sort of countries around that area. But that's definitely not to say that, say, like Australia isn't a polluter or New Zealand isn't a polluter or, you know, any country that has a coastline is a polluter. It's just that some countries contribute a little bit more than others. I mean, it comes down a lot to how countries manage their waste. So, you know, in Australia, for example, we're fairly good with how we manage our waste. Like they all go to tips and the tips are often well controlled, so there's not a lot of flyaway or spillage from those. But unfortunately, not everyone has those same sort of waste management practices. So that's where a lot of the problems lie.
Do you think the banning of single-use plastic is going to make a big difference to this?
And single-use masks maybe as well.
Yeah, true.
I think it will make a difference, but we won't see that difference for a very, very long time. Like there's such a delay from plastic production to the effect we saw from the first time plastic was produced to the environment to then what we're seeing now with entanglement and ingestion in like nest debris. And so even with banning it now, I feel like it might be a bit disheartening because we might not even see the positive benefits in our lifetime, but they'll definitely be a positive effect eventually.
I think it's one of those things that, like, if we don't do something now, it's obviously only going to get worse, and it's only going to continue to get less unless we actually try and do something to stop it. But like Gabriel was saying, like, it's unlikely that we will see any changes anytime soon because there already is so much plastic out there, and especially in our oceans as well. There's this great saying that Jen says, and I'm 100% going to get it wrong because I can never quite remember it, but it's something about if you have a leak, you can mop up the leak for as long as you want, but it's better to turn off the tap. And the same sort of applies for plastics. So we can continue trying to remove plastics from our beaches and from our oceans and, you know, everywhere else that that we find it. But until we actually, you know, turn off that tap and stop plastic production, we're never really going to be seeing a major change. We're only ever going to be cleaning up the mess.
Yeah, that's what we generally talk about with beach cleanups. It's like you say, a different way is the mop and bucket approach. Taps overflowing, but here's the mop and bucket, mop up the floor. So, but that kind of answers the question, you know, when we say, well, because often we say, well, beach cleanups, how much is it actually contributing? We need to go to the source, like you say. But at the same time, if we stop the issue at the source now, the problem is still being compounded over the so many years that actually, it's a two-prong approach because let's stop the problem at the source, but we still have an opportunity to clean up as much as we can to reduce that issue as well. So we really do need to take two approaches, don't we?
Still got to do the mopping.
Yeah.
Still got to do the mopping.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, we like you were saying, you can't just turn off the tap and expect everything's going to get better because it's not. And I fully support beach cleanups, especially because beaches are habitats for like shorebirds, for example, and we don't really want shorebirds ingesting plastics. Or another paper by Jen and Alex, which was, I think, published earlier in the year, looked at the temperature of sand that had lots of plastics within it, and it found that the plastics increased the temperature of the sand. Which might not seem like a big deal, but then if you consider things like sea turtles, they lay their eggs in the sand, and the temperature of the sand determines the sex of the baby hatchlings. So, you know, we do still have to, you know, do those beach cleanups. They're still just as important. But yeah, like you're saying, it's a two-prong approach. We've got to do both. It's not good to just do one or the other. And especially with it's like fragmentation of plastics. If we leave plastics out in the environment, they're going to fragment into smaller and smaller pieces, which means that it's harder to clean it up because there's more pieces to collect. But if we pick up those plastics while they're still whole, then that's only one item that we have to collect in comparison to multiple pieces. So yeah, it's better to act now, I think.
So we've spoken about ingestion, but going back to that paper about nesting material, what is the problem there with birds using debris, plastic, metals, etc., as nesting material?
I guess the biggest problem is just the risk to their health. So I guess most papers will refer to nest debris as entanglement risk. So most seabirds, when they're collecting debris as nesting material, they're going to go for fishing lines or netting, stuff that kind of resembles natural material that they would want to incorporate into a nest. But obviously when they're long, thin strips of plastic, then there's a risk of them getting entangled in it, and then they can't leave the nest, and then they will die or they'll get trapped and starve. So there's that. But then there have also been a few studies that I've looked at some of the other effects of plastic in nests. So it can affect like the ectoparasites that are present in the nest, which can affect like the overall health of the hatchlings and so on.
Chicks have also been observed playing with the debris in the nests, which again could lead to entanglement, or it could lead to possible ingestion as well. So yeah, there's a myriad of risks associated with using plastics or other marine debris as a nest material.
And Megan, in 2018, you were lead author on a paper looking at the use of the marine debris as nesting material. It was a really substantial data set, so surveying 18 locations over 6 years, and your results were pretty shocking. Like, there was a huge amount of nests that actually contained these debris. So, like, what percentage are we talking about here?
So we surveyed a total of 2,220 nests across 6 years, so between 2013 and 2018. And of those 18 locations, we found that 15 of them, or roughly 83% of them, had at least one nest containing debris, while only two of our sites had nests that had no debris, so they were completely clean. Looking a little bit deeper, so of the 2,220 nests that we surveyed or sampled, 14.4% of them had debris in them. And of this, just over 50% of the nests, so 180 nests, had only one item. And there were only 17 nests that had greater than 10 items. So for seabirds, this is not too bad, realistically, considering, you know, so few nests actually had debris. But for two of our sites, so Southwest Cay in the Great Barrier Reef, all of those nests had greater than 10 items. That site was really, really polluted, which might be a little bit surprising considering it is within the Great Barrier Reef and it is a marine protected area. And then another one of our sites in the Caribbean also had a huge amount of debris in the nests as well.
And that would likely be related more to the currents where they're located, hence why perhaps more would have landed on those particular islands or sites?
Yes, absolutely. I'm definitely in the Caribbean as well. I mean, a lot of the currents sort of just circulate around there, and a lot of those islands do have quite high amounts of debris along the shorelines as well. So, Yeah, but the sighting the Great Barrier Reef was quite surprising for our results.
Now, research is always important. It's important for policy making. It's important for education. It's important for all sorts of reasons. And one thing that always amazes me is things like when you start throwing numbers like, oh, well, we counted this amount of plastic or this amount of debris. It's like, do you actually physically go there and pick every single item and count it and so on? Or so there's a paper again that I believe you might have been lead author for as well, but it looked at a standardized method for estimating visible debris in Burzenes. Do you want to give us the background to that? I mean, you're obviously applying some science to this, which is always intriguing, but why firstly the need for the study? I'm surprised there hadn't already been something available that you could just tap into. Here's a tool, and this is how we're going to, you know, get some figures.
For my 2018 paper, we physically removed each of the debris items from the nests, which was great because it meant that we could get really comprehensive data on the debris types, the debris colours, and the mass of debris items. But one of the problems with this method is, I mean, A, it is time consuming. And if you have a colony that has, gosh, I don't know, like 200 nests, it's going to take you a long time to collect all of that data. Another problem with this method is that it is quite destructive. So you are somewhat destroying the nest in the process. What we did in my 2018 study was we removed the debris after the nesting period, so you know the birds didn't need the nest anymore, so it wasn't going to be such a big deal if we removed the debris. But the problem is not all seabirds use their nest once per year or for one breeding season. So there are a number of seabird species that and terrestrial bird species that use their nest in consecutive breeding seasons and consecutive years. So it's unethical for you to go and remove the debris from the nest because you're likely going to destroy their nest and then they're going to either not have a home or have to build an entirely new nest for the next breeding season. So yeah, there's a lot of ethical issues surrounding this. So in 2019, I was fortunate to win a Commonwealth Association of Commonwealth Universities Blue Charter Fellowship, which allowed me to travel to Scotland and work with the University of the Highlands and Islands up in Thurso, which is the northernmost town on the UK mainland. And while I was up there, I developed a method to quantify or to estimate the amount of debris in seabird nests from photographs of those nests. And the whole reason of using photographs is it's non-destructive, it's really quick. I mean, while someone's in a colony, they may be doing monitoring work or something else, they can quickly snap a few photos of some nests and it really doesn't add all that much time to their day. And then someone can then analyze those photos and estimate the amount of debris in those nests in a relatively quick and efficient method. And that's the method I developed. What we do with this method is we use a program called ImageJ, which is it's like scientific Photoshop, sort of, and it has a huge range of capabilities. Like you can count the number of blood cells versus white blood cells, or huge range of things. But what I did with it was I used it to place a grid over a photo of nests or a single nest, and then I outlined the edge of the nest, and then used a plugin called Cell Counter. And basically what it does is you just click on the grid cells that contain debris versus the grid cells that don't contain debris. And then from there, you can get a proportion of the nest that contains debris or either doesn't contain debris. And the good thing about this method is really quick. It's quite simple. And in theory, it should be able to be applied to the the nests of any sort of seabird or terrestrial bird with some sort of modification. So, I'm really happy with how it all turned out, and hopefully people will be able to adopt this method in future studies, which is, I guess, one of the main goals is that we wanted people to use it in future studies so that studies across species and across time and space can be comparable. It's really important to have repeatable and standardized methods so that future studies, regardless of species or location or area or time, we want them to be comparable. And then we can look at trends across time and, you know, see if the pollution is increasing or decreasing or whether it's stable or whatever may be happening.
Yeah. And Gabrielle, you're actually doing a project at the moment with silver gulls. Are you using the same kind of technique for that?
Yeah. So my project essentially is just building on the work that Megan did in that paper. So I'm using the ImageJ method to quantify or estimate realistically the amount of debris that's in silver gull nests here in Tasmania. And I'm also comparing this to what Megan did in her 2018 paper where she physically removed debris. So after we took photographs of the silver gull nest, we also removed the debris and then processed it and like sorted it and weighed it in the lab so that we knew exactly what was in the nest. And the goal of this is to kind of just see whether it is actually feasible to take photographs and get the same sort of information, or whether there might be like a time and place for photographs and a time and place for collecting the debris. And that's kind of what we've come to the conclusion is that you kind of have to pick the method that's going to answer your research question and the kind of data that you want to collect, because you get presence-absence data or count-based data when you're collecting and physically removing debris. Whereas if you do photographs, you're getting proportion data, which is almost more informative. But yeah, it really is depending on your question.
Now, all this deep dive that we're doing and into the research that both of you are doing, do you feel that this research is very particular to, okay, you're monitoring a particular species, right, of birds and so on, and that's all it pertains to. The outcomes is just that. Or do you feel that a lot of this research is actually contributing to a bigger picture with bigger issues we have globally?
That's a good question. The problem of plastics in nests is it's a relatively new topic. It's just relatively new in the literature. So the first sort of papers that looked at plastics in nests came out in 2011, roughly around that time. Which, you know, it's only been, 10 years? And since that first sort of paper, there has been a huge influx in nest debris papers, especially in the last 2 or 3 years. So it's a topic that is growing and rapidly evolving, year by year. And, it's in the same sense that, you know, entanglement and ingestion papers grew in not in popularity, but they grew over time when they first came out, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. It's now that it's nest debris, which has been the new sort of topic, I guess. But I think all of these papers, whether it's nest debris or whether it's entanglement or ingestion or rafting of species on plastics or cellular impacts of plastics, I think they're all contributing to our growing knowledge of the impacts of plastics and how bad they really are. I often think about how plastics are really have really only been in mass production for about the last 70 or 80 years, and that's not even one person's lifetime. So, you know, we don't really know what the long-term impacts of plastics are, not on seabirds or other marine life, but especially not on humans. And that's quite a scary thought, really. You know, what really is it doing to us? Are we breathing it in? What is that doing that to our lungs? What's it? Is it you know, going into our brain? Like, we don't really know. And it's only through the research of, well, wildlife in the first instance, but I'm sure we're going to have research coming out on plastics in humans in years to come. So we'll just see where it all goes. But I'm not overly confident, unfortunately.
Have either of you noticed if any of this research is starting to be translated to, you know, policy change or action on the ground as yet, or are we too early in the piece to really notice those changes?
Like, I know we had the policy on reducing disposal of plastics and other waste off ships, but that came out quite some time ago, after, you know, people realised that plastics are not rubbish dumps and oceans are not rubbish dumps and we can't just chuck rubbish off ships and the plastic just disappears. It doesn't work like that. So there was that policy. I can't think of any recent policy exactly. But I know that, you know, it's like the Hobart City Council in Tasmania are trying to introduce their single-use plastic ban, the same as I think the Northern Territory or Darwin are also trying to do the same. And there's a lot of things like that are going on. So people are trying to introduce policy to stop the release of helium balloons, for example, because helium balloons are terrible for wildlife. There are, I think there's some policy up in Europe or the UK that's trying to reduce the amount of fishing-related debris items, so like nets and ropes and that kind of thing, because of the amount of plastic or especially the amount of fishing-related debris we're finding in northern gannet nests, which are the nests that I was studying in my most recent paper. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of policies that are trying to reduce the amount of plastic that we're using and producing and disposing of. And I mean, I'm sure that they're influenced and at least in part by some of the research that's coming out.
So what can we expect in the near future from the two of you? Any you know, well, if you're allowed to say, but any research that's due to be published or any new projects that you might get involved in, you know, something to look forward to?
I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to say. I do hopefully have a paper coming out at hopefully the end of this year. It's not quite finished. It will be on the silver gulls, so what I was talking about before.
Exciting.
It is exciting. It's a very rare thing from my understanding to have a paper coming out of your undergrad. So I'm very excited and feel very privileged that I've had this opportunity, and I'm sure I'm going to share it on every social media platform possible. I feel like everyone read this. so yeah, and I don't know, I'm hoping to continue on with the Drift Lab into honours and just keep going with this plastic stuff.
So seaweed just dead to you now?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that I'll just like look at it, go for like dives and stuff, but maybe it's not my research calling. I feel like plastics is such a big issue at the moment and I really want to contribute to that.
Megan?
Yes and no. I mean, I'll be one of the co-authors to Gabrielle's paper. So that, again, that is very exciting. I have two more papers due to come out of my PhD, but that's unlikely to be for a little while yet. Next year sometime, I hope. I mean, I'm supposed to finish my PhD in December next year, so I've got until then really to get those out. So yeah, they'll be out eventually, but nothing quite as soon as the silver cull paper.
Yeah, I think this has been hugely insightful because, you know, we talk a lot about microplastics and plastics in the oceans and the effect it has on marine life. We'd never really stop to think about the effect it has on bird life. And, you know, we have in the past, I mean, Dr. Jack Orty, he spoke to us about ingestion of plastics, but, you know, there's a raft of other effects it has. And we've spoken about nesting. We've spoken about, you know, just plain debris lying on a beach and how that can impact the future of certain colonies or species, because if they're all males or they're all females, you have a problem. You know, you're playing with nature's own natural tool in terms of regulating things. So this is important, this kind of conversation, because it puts perspective into the bigger picture. And I think that was kind of my leading question earlier on, is that sometimes we look at things in isolation and think, well, that doesn't really affect us. But it does, because every action that we take has huge ramifications, and not just in one or two aspects, but actually, you know, when we talk about preserving biodiversity and wildlife and sea life and marine life in general, one small action can have a massive impact. And like we say, there's also, the compounding effect. So even if we stop now, well, everything we did 10 years back is only still trying to catch up. So this has been hugely insightful. And it's really exciting to hear, Megan, the journey you've had, the travel you've done. And Gabrielle, I think you're only about to start that similar journey as you continue with your research and your studies. So I think, A, it's very inspiring for up-and-coming students that are thinking about what should I do. Maybe there's still an opening for seaweed research. But I think there's so many opportunities to get involved in research and help shed some light in terms of what we don't get to see or hear. You know, Lord Howe Island, how many of us get to go there? But you have that privilege, you have the opportunity, and you can share the real impact of what we never see. So thank you so much to the two of you for coming onto the show and sharing some of your passion, your true passion.
Thank you so much for having us. It's been an absolute blast. Always love sharing my research, or our research, with everyone. It's always exciting.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. Make sure you subscribe and share this podcast with your friends, and visit the website for more details.